The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and joining me tonight is Brian Hartman.
That's me.
We are here tonight to discuss our latest trio of movies. We watched Unicorn Store, Brie Larson's directorial debut, and we watched Inherent Vice, Paul Thomas Anderson's hippie noir from 2014, and we watched Burning, one of the best films of 2018 by critical acclaim and by some of us, maybe not both of us. We'll have to wait and see. We're going to start off our discussion with Unicorn Store. This is it's several things. It's Brie Larson as a whimsical, somewhat aimless art student, 20-something, who we start the movie having seen her not accepted into an art program and or kicked out of it, somewhat aimless, and she accepts a soul-draining corporate job where she's harassed.
I think it was her show and she failed out of school.
Okay, yeah. She's big into pastel colors and glitter, whereas the teacher is not in any way, shape, or form. As most people shouldn't. I mean, let's be honest. Who's into glitter?
Glitter's really hard to clean up. I've tried to ban it in my house many times.
How's that going?
It's not. It's all over the basement floor right now.
Okay, that's the glitter safe zone, the basement?
No, I just need to go vacuum it up again. Get snuck in here during birthday parties. Anyway, back to Brie Larson.
Yeah, so in between starting this job, she gets an invitation to the titular Unicorn Store from Samuel L. Jackson. They're reuniting based on their work in Captain Marvel. And things go from there. The unicorn does indeed turn out to be real. She has to satisfy several requirements before she can accept ownership of it. And it's this combination of magical realism and corporate satire that I don't think really works. Brian, what'd you think about Unicorn Store?
Samuel L. Jackson has still not found a role where he talks in a normal voice. He's still always overexcited. Brie Larson was what every boomer thinks a millennial is. I think that's an apt description of her character.
It's fair.
There was one scene I liked that I can remember. That pretty much covers it. I can't tell anybody to go watch this. I just wouldn't.
Like, do you think she's a believable person in the world, or is she a boomer's caricature of a millennial, as you said?
She's a boomer's caricature of a millennial. Absolutely. This person doesn't exist.
I'm surprised that Brie Larson would play this character. It seems out of her wheelhouse. It's a different page for her. She like her like big star making roles are in movies like Short Term 12 and Room, where I mean she doesn't have to play like abused and damaged female characters for the rest of her life by any means, but to go to the complete opposite of this character whose whimsy is being crushed by the system, I don't know. I don't know if this character works for anybody.
I don't think anybody saves the script.
Yeah, that's fair. Like
the kid, her friend, whatever, her boyfriend or mm-hmm. guy at the hardware store, he was amusing to watch. Like, I thought he did a really good job of just playing, you know, guy who works at a hardware store.
I think that actor whose name, and I apologize if I get the pronunciation wrong, but his name is Mamadou Afi. He's playing as normal a person as has ever existed in relief to her and her glitter and her various coats and colors and rainbows and everything else that Brie Larson's kit is all about. Right. As far as like the corporate satire, I think they were on firmer ground there. I think there might have been like a complete movie in Kit trying to acclimate herself to selling vacuums.
The friend and the copy machine and the corporate sales pitch, having watched all of Mad Men and then watching that sales pitch, was perfect.
Absolutely. I did like the sales pitch. I'll give Unicorn Store for the sales pitch. That was fun. Or that was in sharp relief to like what you expect in that situation. And like, again, credit to Brie Larson. The costuming on what she chose to wear to that, like where she looks like a Christmas tree who's spitting out glitter instead of pollen. Like, there's something to that.
Do you think the guys from Mad Men respond better than whatever weird vacuum place that was?
Probably not. I bet Roger Sterling would be somewhat into it. He would appreciate the experience that this was happening. Like, maybe he thought he had taken acid when he hadn't.
Right. That's what I'm thinking. It depends on if they're on drugs or not when they watch her present with her glitter.
Yes, if this is the Speed episode and Kit strides in and trying to sell vacuum cleaners, that maybe they maybe they give her a huge contract and then wake up 3 days later questioning what they've done.
If we had a YouTube channel and we mashed this together, I think this would be a big hit.
Okay. I'm just going to edit this out. And I hope I remember. I'm making a little note right now. I hope in the time between recording this and editing it that I don't lose said note and put this fantastic idea out into the ether for other people to steal.
Step one, learn how to edit video.
What's the tail end of YouTube? It's youtube.gov, right?
Exactly. Watch all the drone strikes you want.
All right, fantastic. Where I think a movie does not exist is in the whole magical realism, unicorns exist, blah, blah, blah. Touchy-feely, it needs love and a safe environment. And I could not even pretend to care about all that. I mean, thank you, Samuel L. Jackson, for being game enough to like tie tinsel into your hair. Well done. But everything in that corner of the film, which is, you know, like that's what's driving her. Everything in that corner is unimpressive and silly, and it doesn't gel with the rest of the world. It's hard to imagine her boss like walking past a warehouse park and considering whether or not to walk into the unicorn store.
Yeah, they totally lost me. And I thought they could have done a better job. Well, we haven't talked about her parents yet. Mm-hmm. Her camp leading boomers leave corporate America parents, but they didn't do anything for me either.
I kind of thought there was something there in that Kit explains to them that all of the teens that they're working with are stringing them along and serving them a rasher of bullshit. But I did like that they knew, but they understood that the lying is part of the process. Perhaps it's good that they're there instead of other places that they could be based on their life circumstances. Like, they do need to be here in whatever environment that this camp is supposed to provide. Because Kit is a fundamentally frivolous person, I think the movie mostly knows this, but I think because the lead actor is also the director, it doesn't quite come all the way through. It has perhaps too much sympathy for someone who is acting so frivolously in relief to these teens who have actual problems beyond, I didn't get into the art program that I wanted to.
Right. I think about, like, if this were my daughter and she goes to college and fails out after 1 year, and like goes off and is buying hay and turning our laundry room into a stable. Like,
go on.
I don't even know how you would respond to that in any normalcy. It's just, I feel like the movie at that point, when you say it out loud, needs to become mental breakdown movie.
Yes.
Not lovey-dovey, fall in love with the hardware store kid movie. Like, she's full on lost it and needs to go see a therapist big time.
And the movie kind of goes that way, where the store suddenly disappears and she can't convince anybody that it's real, but then everything is indeed real and she turns down the unicorn at the end with her new boyfriend and someone else will get the unicorn and everything's great and wonderful.
Yeah,
nice. She doesn't need it anymore. She destroyed her whatever her parents shed for nothing. There's potentially a movie here, but like I don't know. I think this kind of earnest, whimsical, millennial movie trying to find herself, that's kind of a played out movie sub genre, where there are bigger problems in the world, and it's hard to really sympathize with someone who just isn't getting exactly what they wanted.
I wonder if I used to love Garden State. I wonder if I went back and watched that, if it aged well at all.
I have never seen that movie, but its reputation is pretty well in the garbage.
Yeah, I remember liking it at the time, but I mean, I was a different person, and the world was way different back then. So, anyway, that's just what like whimsical finding yourself movie brought to mind.
That. Strangely enough, Garden State might just come up later in this podcast.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Okay. Like New Jersey or the movie?
The movie. I've got it on my mind. Or movies like it anyways. Here or there. I'm spoiling the rest of this podcast. We want listeners to stay tuned. Our next movie is Inherent Vice. This is an adaptation of a Thomas Pynchon novel. Famously opaque, famously indirect. Maybe not famously. I only know about it because of the movie and all the podcasts I listened to around that time of its release. It stars Joaquin Phoenix as a stoner private detective who is tasked with finding a missing person, a missing real estate tycoon who is also the lover of his ex-girlfriend, Shasta Faye Hepworth, played by Catherine Waterston, and... Joaquin Phoenix's character, Doc Sportello, traipses across late 60s, early 70s LA, running into various colorful characters, whorehouses, the beginnings of the rehab industry, dentists who snort a lot of cocaine. There's a lot going on in Inherent Vice.
It's like you described the beginning on what Doc was tasked with, the main character, and then once you figure that out, you probably have to watch the movie 8 times to figure out what happens between the moment he gets the job and the end of the movie, because there's so much going on. I felt like the guy from the meme from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where he's got like the push pins in the wall and the strings attached all over the place.
Yes, I can't remember. I can't remember what the name that Charlie says over and over and over again is, but yeah, it's in that vein.
That's how I felt for it.
This is the second time that I've seen Inherent Vice, and I saw it when it came out in 2014.
You said it came out in 2014. I would have, if not even kidding, I thought for sure this was like 1998.
What's that based on? What screamed late 90s about Inherent Vice for you?
Just the way it looked. Like, nothing about it was modern in any way. So I don't know. Just seemed like a movie like, the Las Vegas movie.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yeah. Yeah, seems in the vein of that. Was that 1998-ish?
I think it was, yeah. I think it was exactly that.
That's a hell of a guess.
All right, good pull. I'm going to pull out your surprise in the editing, and we'll make you sound professional. Quick sidebar, like, Paul Thomas Anderson is my favorite working director. He is continuously awesome in everything he does. So that colored my initial viewing of this movie, where, again, I was unable to follow the plot. And as the movie goes on, you're somewhat encouraged to throw your hands up and just go along scene by scene and see what happens and see where it's going. We'll get into like whether that's defensible or not from like a critical perspective. But on a rewatch, I really decided I was going to try and follow, see if it's even possible. And I left the second viewing with just as much of a headache as I remember having after watching the movie for the first time. This is an impenetrable movie.
I don't know. I watched the first hour and thought to myself, okay, I'm in it. And then, it got really late. So I thought I'd finish the next day. And the next day, I watched for like 10 minutes. And I did that. I really did just say, I'm just going to watch the characters. I don't even care about the plot anymore. And I found it very enjoyable. Like, once I had given up on trying to follow the plot, like being able to just pay attention to what the characters are doing in the scene and what they're saying and what's going on in the background and how it kind of blends together and like, whatever, you'll figure it out in the end anyway. I thought I enjoyed it.
Yeah, like Paul Thomas Anderson isn't, I think, what anybody would call a director. Like, he doesn't make comedies. No one would say There Will Be Blood on its face is a comedy. He, however, does describe his movies as comedies. And between this and Boogie Nights, both are arguably the funniest movies of their respective years. There's so much like physical humor in Inherent Vice, specifically Joaquin Phoenix, who you don't necessarily think of as a comedic actor either, but he's great with the pratfall, he's great with a confused look, and then you got Josh Brolin as his, like, certainly not partner, but like secondary antagonist, playing a detective, a Bigfoot Bjornsson, who is so going for like ramrod straight and upright and conservative that his every step is laughable. And those are just like the top two credited actors. And it kind of goes from there.
Yeah, I love Brolin playing the police officer. Just like thinking back to him in the diner, slant more pancakes.
Yes. Even though,
and then at the end, they're in a Japanese diner or whatever. Because the music, and you can just tell, and he's yelling more pancakes, I think, in Japanese.
Yes.
And then in the end, the chef just responds in English. He's just like, yeah, okay. I was like, oh, okay.
Monto pancakeu.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he's not eating Japanese breakfast. He's eating breakfast in the Japanese restaurant. It is just pancakes. To say nothing of his love affair with various popsicles and him eating an entire tray of weed at the end and one last final fuck you to Doc Sportello. This is a very funny movie. As far as the plot itself, let's see if we can't crack it here.
Do you have your push pins and your string and your profile pictures up on your wall? Right at the start. Can you get somebody in the house to come film this?
Yeah, I've got it all prepared. I've got a nice wall cleared and ready to go. And here, and this is where we're going to start. Okay, so there's the Shasta Faye Hepworth sphere, wherein her boyfriend has had an epiphany and wants to give all of his money away because housing should be free in his own drug-addled terms. And
wait, you're like two-thirds of the way through the show when we realize that, right?
Or yes. Am I missing? Okay. Yes, the whole thing, the whole global view of Inherent Vice. Okay. He's not allowed to do that by the FBI, who want him to use his money to buy a hotel or buy a casino in Vegas to break up the control of the mob there. Okay. The FBI does this by taking Mr. Wolfman, Mickey Wolfman. Sidebar, the names in Inherent Vice, each and every one, are delightful. The FBI is represented by Agent Flatweed and Agent Borderline, played by Timothy Simons from Veep. The FBI secrets away Mr. Wolfman in a rehab facility run by who we come to discover is the Golden Fang. And the Golden Fang are a drug cartel who are trying to vertically integrate their business. They're going to sell heroin to addicts, and then they're going to funnel addicts through their rehab system. And one of those people caught in this loop... Like,
is this the Purdue Pharma origin story?
I mean, this book was written, I want to say, in the mid-90s. Which was right around that time. Let's just double check. Oh, 2009. Never mind. Purdue Pharma was well up and running by that point. So one of the people caught up in this vertical integration is Coy Harlingen, who is also an informant for the police and for the FBI in their pursuit of breaking up like revolutionary groups, Black Panthers and the like, as represented by Michael K. Williams, Tariq Khalil in his one early scene. And Doc is put on Coy Harlingen's case by wife Hope Harlingen. Yeah, he's been missing from their family for a long time since he was on drugs. But Doc is able to not bring down the Golden Fang, to not free Mickey Wolfman. All that he's really able to do is trade a lot of money that he gets from a tip from Bigfoot Bjornsson to go after Jesus Christ. To go after the people that killed his partner long ago, a gentleman named Adrian Prussia, another fantastic name. And Doc kills Adrian Prussia, gets a bunch of heroin or money, I don't remember exactly, trades it to someone high up in the Golden Fang in exchange for Coy Harlingen's freedom. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, I saw the movie and I didn't understand most of what you were talking about.
And I left out so much.
Right.
Shasta Faye Hepworth, and again, it's important to always say her full name, as everybody in the movie says her full name. She's involved in all of this, like, third hand. She has a general sense of what's going on.
Third hand? I thought she was dating the real estate mogul guy.
She was, but I think that sphere... I think that sphere exists wholly separate from the Golden Fang stuff. But again, I would have to go back and watch it again.
Partnering with real estate guy's wife to get him, I don't remember. I thought they were trying to scam him out of all his money at the beginning.
Well, Mickey Wolfman's wife and her trainer lover are trying to prevent Mickey Wolfman from giving all his money away. So they're in league with the FBI.
Oh, I thought they were trying to scam his money away from him.
No, they just want to keep it.
I misread most of this movie. Okay.
And I could totally be wrong because, like I said, pretty serious headache after watching this movie. I think the right way to consume Inherent Vice is to not care about the plot. It's very important, I think, that Doc, when he breaks out his notepad, it's not to take down details. It's not to, you know, provide a note for himself, a reminder for himself to check out this at a later date. It's to remind himself that this is in fact happening. You're not hallucinating. Everything that is happening is real. And he does this so early in the movie as to suggest that future moments will not be real, and the viewer isn't really going to know which one is which. And
everything was real, though, right?
I think so.
That's what I thought. Her only question after watching this movie was, why did the dentist get in the car?
I'm just going to chalk that up to cocaine, I think.
That's what I said. I just said, I think he had somewhere to go, I guess. I didn't really know what he was
doing.
I think if you had a small amount of drugs in your body, this movie might get elevated even higher. Like the type where you just don't care. You're just like, whatever.
Where you just get to enjoy Josh Brolin really giving it to a chocolate popsicle.
Exactly.
You don't have to think about the subtext or where they're going or anything like that. Just focus on the popsicle. Right. So if that's the plot, then I think that's pretty coherent. That's pretty solid as, if Doc Sportello is your protagonist, not a person who's going to get stuff done, all that he can do in this complex machinery of the FBI and real estate and drugs and rehab is just to save one person. The movie goes a long, long way to get to that point. But I do remember And I was in the second viewing, but I was like really affected by that idea that you can't stop the Golden Fang. They've already won. And that's another like sub thread in the movie is the setting itself. This really melancholy fog, and there's a lot of fog in this movie, weed and weather induced both, of people that had a lot of optimism in the early 60s, mid 60s, summer love times, realizing that they have lost. They're not going to change anything. And the powers that be went to a lot of trouble to ensure that all the counterculture in the 60s is going to have as small of an impact as possible. Did you get any of that from the movie?
No. Okay. Not at all. I mean, maybe a little bit, just like hippiedom was an exercise in futility, pretty much.
I think the movie makes it clear that that wasn't always the case. Like there was a period of
optimism. Like the transition period.
Yeah.
Where they were making inroads, and then, you know, it all went downhill.
Yeah, and Doc and people like him might have been singularly unable to go up against the Bigfoot Bjornsons of the world and the people that are far above him. What they had to offer was just future satire. Like he's like Bigfoot. When he's not on camera, when he's not working for the police, is trying to break into commercials. And the first time we see him, he's dressed up as a hippie in an afro and those little hippie glasses trying to sell something. I don't remember exactly. So
I missed that. I only saw him playing the police officer on TV.
There's a couple scenes where you find out that he has like an agent and he's trying to get on and he's like trying to be an extra in cop shows and that kind of stuff. And it's not working out for him. Bigfoot Bjornsson. Great character.
That's great. As someone who's terrible with names, by the end of this movie, I knew maybe half their names, which is quite an accomplishment.
It's very important in movies to say a character's name in full and repeatedly.
What was your grade on this one?
I went down to a B on Inherent Vice from a B+. I wrote in my review back in 2014 that if I watch this again, I bet it could conceivably be one of the best movies of the decade. And some people do feel this way, like this, it's not one of Paul. Like if you're going to talk about Paul Thomas Anderson and like where he fits in modern directors, I don't necessarily know that a lot of people would cite Inherent Vice as opposed to like Boogie Nights or The Master or There Will Be Blood. But this movie has its fans, but I'm getting further away from being one.
I don't know. I'm into like a B+. I enjoyed it. It was bonkers. I like a good bonkers movie, though.
Yeah. I think a movie like this probably should be shorter. It's 149 minutes.
That's true. I did take two sittings, but I'd take two sittings for most movies at this point.
Totally fair. Yeah. Our final movie.
Hold on, we got to go back. What was your grade for Unicorn Store?
Oh, sure. I think I gave a C- to Unicorn Store.
It seems generous. I think I'm going to do a D-. Hold on, Lily's going to tap dance into the room.
I could see the better movie with the corporate stuff, which was solid, and the slight undercutting of Kit's life goals, which I'm always down for. Adulthood is compromise.
Yeah. Okay.
Our final movie is Lee Chang-dong's South Korean mystery film Burning. This stars Yoo Ah-in, Steven Yuen, and Jeon Jong-seo as something of a love triangle. This is a movie that's got a lot on its mind. It's about as long as Inherent Vice, but it's got about a tenth of the characters, if not less. This is a movie about class in South Korea, about youth unemployment, about passion, about understanding what you want out of life. And it's also a really compelling mystery as far as what's happening, what isn't happening, and you leave the movie never really knowing. The star of the movie, played by Yoo Ah-in, is a guy named Lee Jong-soo. His dad is on trial for assault. They are a farming family. They live very close to the North Korean border. He got his degree in writing, but he doesn't write. He can't. He's not really getting much out. He wants to be a novelist, but he hasn't really made any headway into that. Doesn't know what he's going to write about, even if he were to start. And he runs into a childhood acquaintance, a woman named Shin Hae-mei, and she's similarly underemployed. She's working as like a booth girl trying to sell something. It's never really clear what she's trying to sell, unless I missed that detail. They hook up. She was very much into him when they were children, but he was not. He barely remembers her at all. For whatever reason, they hook up, and she is filled with a lot of wanderlust. So shortly after this, she's off on a vacation to Kenya. While she's in Kenya, and Jong-soo is like watching her apartment and being somewhat creepy about it, Hae-mei returns with Ben, played by Steven Yeun, and he is a mysterious guy. He's got a lot of money, although we never see him working, and we kind of go from there. Brian, what'd you think about Burning?
Go from there. That was like 2/3 of the movie. Maybe it wasn't. It took a long time for anything to happen. That's what I thought of the movie. I feel like you're right in all the topics they wanted to discuss, but it didn't do it for me because they didn't do anything basically the whole movie. I think there was a little bit of mystery, but that was like 5 minutes, and then it'd be like 15 minutes of the sunset.
Okay, we're going to put a pin in the sunset talk.
Oh my gosh.
We will return to that.
Can I pick a different analogy so we don't have to talk about
this? No, we're going to talk about it. The thrust of the film, it's not a romance. It's very much a thriller / mystery. At a certain point, Hae-mei disappears, and Jong-soo suspects that Ben has done something nefarious, and he investigates, and he finds a lot of circumstantial evidence. Maybe Ben is guilty, maybe he's not. And ultimately, with what evidence he has, Ben is killed by Jong-soo, who flees the scene naked and crying. Brian, do you think Ben is a murderer of young women, or do you think he's just someone who moves through them romantically and quickly?
Oh man, I had my dad watched this with me.
Nice.
We were talking about this afterwards, and we both just didn't really care that much what he was because we just weren't invested. I think he was killing them, like the greenhouse analogy. But whatever, it just wasn't a great analogy, and I didn't have enough invested in the characters.
That's acceptable. This movie very much rests on these three characters. And yeah, if you can't get into him, you can't get into him. Like, Jong-soo is not a likable guy, I don't think. He conveys a level of like normalcy, but he's also... they make a choice to show him jerking off in Hae-mei's empty apartment. That's not an endearing quality.
Yeah, that's, you know, whatever. I was more concerned with the fact that he couldn't remember who she was and they grew up in the same small town. Like, that's weird. I felt like he was just putting on a show. Like, how could you possibly be that oblivious?
I grew up in a small town. I believe you did too. You don't remember everybody.
I surely remember something about them.
And I mean, there's reason to doubt Jaime's account of their childhood as well. Like, her family thinks that she makes up a lot of stories. It's never concrete. Like, what bonds Hae-mei to Jong-soo is that she says that he pulled her out of a well that she fell into when they were children. She was a Korean baby Jessica. And whether or not that happened is up for debate as far as the details of the movie are concerned.
Right. So did this movie have any facts in it the whole time, or was everything just I think maybe that's the appeal of the movie, is you're left guessing the whole time as to what is real and what is not.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's a big part of your appeal.
I need to call my dad tomorrow.
It's one thing for a movie to be like Inherent Vice, deliberately opaque and just throw so much detail at you that you can't keep it straight without a legal pad or the aforementioned strings and thumbtacks and blank walls. With Burning, there's a limited number of possibilities, but there's enough evidence to support any conclusion, and I think the movie does a good enough job in stressing what its themes are to where either result, and there's really only one or two results, like makes sense with what the movie is trying to say. And I think that's where the critical praise is really rooted in. And as far as connecting with the characters, I mentioned that I was going to bring up Garden State again, and here we go. The character of Jaime, who is a person who is very charming and very sexually forward, and she has a lot of idiosyncratic hobbies. Like, she likes to, she travels, sure, but she's also into mime, and she would fit firmly, like, in the trope of a character like Natalie Portman from Garden State, the famous manic pixie dream girl, who only exists to, like, bring the male character out of some, like, depressive funk. And if this was a worse movie, that would be all she is. But again, as far as, like, bonding the viewer to the character, it's, and as I wrote in my review as well, like, it's only the characters who think of her in that way. The movie itself does a fantastic job stressing what an individual she is, how she has just so much questioning and yearning going on inside of her that neither Ben nor Jong-Soo are well suited to address at all. The whole sundown scene, I completely respect someone just wondering when this scene is going to end.
Or any scene.
Okay. But that sunset scene for me could have gone on another 10 or 15 minutes. I thought that was perfect and beautiful and indicative of her mental state. And she doesn't say anything, but it's clear what she wants and what she's doing. And the way it ends is really heartbreaking, with Jong-Soo, like, scolding her after it in the last thing that he ends up saying to her. That, like, the movie rests on that scene, and it boosts it all the way up into the stratosphere for me.
Oh my gosh. I think a nuclear missile from North Korea could have boosted this movie into the stratosphere. That's... Ugh.
Okay. I mean, yeah, it's a slow movie. This is 148 minutes to Inherent Vice is 149 minutes. That's
Name
a long movie.
Name a slower movie. Name a single movie that is slower than this one.
Oh, I don't remember what it was called exactly. I want to say it was called Stray Dog, but it was a movie about... Maybe that was also a South Korean movie. It was either a South Korean movie or a Japanese movie, but it was about homeless people in either Seoul or Tokyo. And it ended with a scene of two characters staring at a blank wall to stress the boredom of their environment. Mm-hmm. And I think it went on for 17 minutes. It went on for so long that one of the actors in the scene let a tear go. And over the course of this very long take, you could see the tear descend, leave a track, and then dry. And you were just left with, like, the salt of the streak. And it was...
That's good filmmaking.
Truly one of the worst art movies I've ever seen. That was about the same length as this, and it was demonstrably slower. I don't know what's going on in this part of the world necessarily, but they really take their time.
Lives. They live rapid lives. They need to slow down at the movie theater.
That might very well be it.
I'm on it. I brought my A game.
I just really think there's too much going on in Burning for me to call it slow. It takes its time, sure, but I don't know what I would cut compared to Inherent Vice, which is, you know, packed with incident, but so much of it doesn't necessarily impact the plot or the plot of Inherent Vice, which, you know, I think collapses into a diamond of just a man, a detective rescuing a husband and returning him to his family. Whereas Burning doesn't have any of the extraneous cocaine dentist stuff. It's as economic as it can possibly be in showing you who all of these people are within certain constrictions. You don't really want to know that much about Ben. You want to keep him mysterious, and he is unquestionably mysterious to the point where maybe he is a serial killer. Maybe he's just a dude who enjoys short relationships.
Maybe. The thing is, you gotta get the viewer to care first, and it's just, I think that's a...
And again, I'm Jaime is a great character, and if she is the stakes of the movie, then great, I'm with you.
If we were gonna watch a movie tomorrow, and I gave you the choice between Inherent Vice and Burning, which one are you picking?
Probably Inherent Vice.
Yeah. All right. Good choice.
Even though I like Burning a logarithmic grade level more than Inherent Vice, this is an A for me. This is one of my favorite movies from 2018. I did watch it again in preparation for this podcast in my review. Available on MediaCommovie.club, and it remains.
Mm. My review, found on the back of your eyelids.
Sure.
There you go. I don't know. C, I guess, whatever. Maybe the cat's alive. Maybe it's not. Maybe I'm just rooting for the cat. That's my summary of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it provides no answers. Maybe the cat was hers. Maybe the cat was Ben's. Who the hell knows? And you gotta love that ambiguity.
Yeah, you gotta something that ambiguity. When do we get to start hyping Deadwood instead of talking about other movies
or other TV shows that just ended ignominiously? Woof. We're not fully done talking about Game of Thrones just yet. We are gonna do a series wrap up. But after that series wrap up, in our immediate future at the Mutica Movie Club, we will be discussing the Deadwood movie, which will be finally released 13 years after the cancellation of Deadwood. It'll be released at the end of May, and we'll be there. The ambulators will be there shortly after to discuss it and probably do some cruel masquerade, bring that glorious tradition back to prominence.
Can we do a separate podcast for each scene of the movie? Every time the camera changes.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a long podcast. I guarantee it. We're going to really get into it. I am shocked that the Deadwood movie is happening. I continue to be shocked. It's kind of a miracle. Extra poignant, seeing as genius writer David Milch now has Alzheimer's and is, you know, certainly on the way down and the way out, and only has so many masterpieces left in him. And judging by the critical reaction, this is going to be one of them. And I'm very excited to see it. That's May 31st.
I told Shane I've been practicing walking with perfect posture and uninterested face in honor of Seth Bullock to really get that.
Of course, it has been 13 years since Deadwood aired anything new, and I think the most significant losses in that period of time are Powers Booth as Cy Tolliver, and perhaps more importantly, Ralph Richardson as Richardson will also sadly not be in this movie. As much time on screen as Cy Tolliver had, and as great as Powers Booth was, I am probably going to be missing Richardson more.
Couldn't they just like CGI some of these guys in there? Actually, it would be like what's that movie on HBO with the Western and the artificial intelligence where I didn't watch season two.
Oh, Westworld?
Westworld, yeah. They can just borrow some of Westworld's robot people and turn this in.
If I'm Ralph Richardson's family, I am keeping an ironclad legal lock on his likeness because there has never been nor will there ever be another person that looked anything like him. You can't just stick that guy in the background of your movie and not have everybody immediately stop it. Like, what's that person? Who's that back there?
Are we going to avoid the pick any homeless person jokes on finding someone to look just like him?
Well, I mean, I don't know Ralph Richardson's backstory exactly, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that that is how he was discovered by David Milch. check us out for those future podcasts and past podcasts, breaking down this last season of Game of Thrones, discussing the odd movie here or there, Avengers Endgame, movie trios that we do every month, so on and so forth. Those all exist, as well as reviews of movies recent and long past at MediaCommovie.club. Like us on Facebook at MediaCommovieClub. Follow us on Twitter at MediaCommovieCall. And if you click on the Amazon link on our website and shop as normally, the link will take you directly to Amazon. And we get a small percentage of that sale at no cost to you. And it helps us with the technical expertise that you're currently experiencing, if not already experienced, in our Game of Thrones finale episode, which, again, I apologize for that. Not our best work. From a technical standpoint, from a content standpoint, it's harder to judge. I'll leave that up to the listener. Brian, thank you for joining me tonight.
It's been a pleasure. See ya.
Have a good night.